Hey, everybody. My name is Murph. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, good morning. My home group is the Common Solution Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet Thursday nights in Charlottesville, Virginia. My sobriety date is June 1st, 2001. And thanks a lot for everybody being here today. This is going to be a great conference. I've heard Joyce on several occasions, and I've heard the disc of Dwayne, and I cannot wait to meet that gentleman and hear his story today, a true gentleman of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea what I'm going to talk about. I really never even think these things through, so I tend to just get rolling, and we always see what comes out of my mouth. And the first thing I wanted to talk about this morning was the thing that dawned on me whenever I was driving up here. And what dawned on me as I'm driving up here with Sean, who drove, and Travis, who came along in the same car, and a bunch of home group guys who came up to support me and basically make sure that I tell you the truth, was the unity of this fellowship, how we can stand behind each other. People in the home group, how we stand up and how we'll help people get up, especially after a guy like me will fall down and get my britches dirty over and over again. See, I used to think that I'd be able to pull myself up by my bootstraps and, you know, and just lead life successfully on my own self-propulsion, on my own willpower. Today, even, you know, at almost 12 years of sobriety, I'm more acutely aware of how I need the people in the room's help. See, I can pray all day long, but really, whenever I hear the voice of Alcoholics Anonymous and the voice of God is through its members, and the people closest to me are those in my home group. You know, the relationships that I build here, I'm going to tell you what the most valuable asset that I have. There was a point in time whenever me and my home group members, we put on a conference very similar to this. And I'll tell you what, when that conference was over, man, I was on fire. All the speakers were awesome. Everything went off like a hitch. There were people that were helped. And I'll tell you, I'm still alcoholic, you know. And what happened was I got a phone call directly after that meeting. And what I heard and what was told to me were two different things. See, whenever I get filled with fear, even after going through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and becoming active here, I still have this problem is that I don't hear exactly the right thing. And I was really scared because my girlfriend called me up. And what she said to me was is that our dog had died. And it died in front of my son. Now, whenever I heard that, I got really scared and I got really angry at the same time. And what happens whenever I get in that state is I tend to make up my own reality. And what I heard was not what was spoken. I heard that my son had killed my dog. And I'll tell you, you know, I was very upset. And I'm in the car and I'm on my way home and I'm ready to go home and I'm ready to get down to basics and I'm getting ready to make sure that this thing is settled correctly. And I'll tell you what, I was not a spiritually minded person. But I'll tell you what, maybe it was the day conference, maybe it was the fact that I asked God for help, but I called up a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was coming back from that same day conference. And I'll tell you what, the most important thing happened that day was he picked up that phone. And I told him what was going down, and I'll tell you what, he talked me down from that ledge, and I was able to go home and not be a punishing person. I was able to go home and be of service. And then I found out the truth of my reality. That happens to me over and over and over again. And that's why I think that the most vital asset I have today, along with the connection with the power greater than myself, is a connection with the people in my home group. And then it springs outward. See, the life that I have today, whenever I tell my story, there was a lot of hardship, there was a lot of like selfish and self-centered activity, and of course there was a lot of drinking. But really, my life today is better than anything I could have ever expected. And I owe it all to the people in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Whenever I look around this room today, I see many people that have helped me along the way. And I'll tell you what, there's a lot of people in here I'd rather hear speaking than hear myself talking, to be honest with you. And, you know, it's just by the grace of God, by taking actions that I didn't even believe would help me. Whenever I started drinking, you know, I wasn't searching for anything. I just wanted to fit in. You know, there was points in times where I got drunk, you know, very early. But I'll tell you, there was a point in time where I realized by looking at my surroundings that I didn't want to be a part of this thing, drinking, alcoholism, because I grew up with it. 3 out of 4 of my grandparents died of cirrhosis, and I saw 2 of them die before my eyes. And I'll tell you, you know, I mean, it wasn't a pretty thing, and I didn't want any part of it. Because, I mean, I grew up poor. I grew up in a trailer park. I saw active alcoholism, and I saw the results of it. I saw broken homes. I saw my family feud. And I'll tell you what, you know, it just didn't seem like it was something I wanted to do. I just wanted to play baseball. You know, that's all I wanted to do when I was growing up. And I'll tell you, you know, I mean, it was tough growing up for me, growing up poor, you know. And it's not it didn't have to be tough, but I made it tough. Because what I would do long before I took a drink of alcohol and I received the effect that I so long desired was I was measuring my outsides with other people's outsides. Most of my friends had nice new fancy homes and they had cars and they had all that stuff. And I'll tell you what, from the earliest times that I can remember, I never measured up and I never felt a part of. And I'll tell you what I would do is I would separate myself from everybody around me. And how I would do that, I would put on a show for you. I was a class clown. I learned very quickly how to tell you exactly what you wanted to hear. And I'll tell you, you know, I mean, it was a tough way to live. Early on in my life, I remember at ages like 8 through 12, thinking that suicide was a viable option in my life. And I didn't know why, you know. And what would happen was alcohol would, I think I'm that guy where alcohol saved my life long enough to get me into the rooms of AA. You know, and I truly believe that. The first time that I drank that I had the effect that I saw was a day when three of my sisters all came home and they wanted to go out for a drink. Now, mind you, I've watched my grandfather drink himself to death to this point. I didn't want any part of it. So we went out to the local tavern and, you know, it was amazing. You know, we went out there and they all got their drinks and they were like, Merv, you're 16. You know, you can just get a Coke or do whatever you want. And without batting an eye, when that bartender came down to me and said, what would you like? I said, I would like a double Jim Beam and Coke. And I have no reason why I wanted that. But I'll tell you what, whenever I drank that down, even though I've drank before, the elusive effect that I sought occurred that day. And we've all had that moment where all of a sudden everything was right in the world. The people out there, my sisters, were like less scary. I could initiate conversation with them. And I think on that day I laughed wholeheartedly for the very first time in my life. I think I did. You know, I mean, I felt connected. And I'll tell you, you know, I mean, it didn't run off and become a daily drinker overnight. But I'll tell you what, I started to pursue it as much as I could. And I'll tell you what, that feeling that it gave me, that I'm okay, and it doesn't matter what's going on or what people think of me, everything's going to be all right. I would chase that illusion for years and years to come. See, early on, when I was just watching my grandpa drink and I was watching my dad drink, you know, I got a very good awareness, looking back on it now, of the different types of alcoholics that come into AA. My dad was one of those guys who, I remember, oh my God, there was a point in time where I had to call my mom to come pick us up, and he looked like one of us. I mean, there were times when he was just going to have one or two, and he'd have too many, and I had to call mom. And then there were times when he'd go in the wagon for good, but he'd return to alcohol. But later on in life, I mean, he hasn't had a drink in over 20 years. He had a grandbaby. They found a spot on his liver, and he had the sufficient force to stop drinking. And from that day, he didn't seek Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't seek a shrink. He didn't seek any kind of medical professional help. He just stopped drinking. And once he got over the DTs, he became happy and sober. He hasn't had a drink since. And I still sniff around. I ask him all the time, like, hey, are you going nuts or anything, you know? And he's just like, nah. He's just like, life is good, you know? He leads a well-meaning, a generous life. He takes care of my mom, who's suffering from all kinds of illnesses. She's bedridden, and he's happy doing it. He's glad to be of service. And I'm going to tell you what, you know, I'm not that guy. When I watched my grandfather drink himself to death, my mom, when he moved in with us, my mom had this great idea of how she could help him control and enjoy his drink. And what she did was she had him take me along to bars with him, you know, so he could like slow down his drinking because Murphy's going along to the bar with him, you know. And I'll never forget it. There was this place called the Milroy Hotel, and it's a honky tonk, and it's one of those places in Pennsylvania that don't have windows, you know what I'm saying? And we go in there about noontime, and you know, and oh my God, we weren't even be the first people there. And I'll never forget, it was the first time I saw this woman named Joanne C., and she was the person that she had to help get, you know, she would be shaking so bad to get those first couple ones down. And when I'm sitting there and everybody's like looking down, and I'm like, you know, this 12, 13-year-old kid, and I'm like, oh, my God, look at these people. You know, if I ever turn out like one of these guys, man, shoot me. You know what I'm saying? And, I mean, it was tough. But something magical would happen. About 45 minutes into it, all of a sudden people would become awake. All of a sudden they'd start laughing. Then somebody put a quarter in a jukebox and everybody would be getting along, you know, and there'd be laughter and there'd be jovial activity, you know, and I mean, it was like, it was the wackiest thing to see it. But what they were doing was they were getting the effect of alcohol and they were able to come out of themselves. And I'll tell you, you know, I mean, I'm sitting there and little would I realize at the age of 33, 20 years later, I would be sitting in that same bar stool, looking at that same mirror, wondering what's wrong with my life. You know, and I would end up in that same place. Growing up, alcohol was awesome. I mean, it was. I'm not one of those people that's going to condemn the effects of alcohol. Like I said, I think it kept me alive long enough to get here. I'll tell you, you know, and early on, you know, they talk about that magic bullseye, and I would hit it. I mean, I would hit it, you know, and I mean, I would feel okay with the world, and it would help me take actions that seemed like normal living. You know, I was able to go to baseball practice and be okay. I was able to, like, kind of show up and be around my family, even though I didn't feel really connected to them. And I'll tell you, what it did for me was it took this overweight, friendless kid that comes from a trailer park. And by the time I was a senior in high school, I was president of my class. I was dating a prom queen. And I'll tell you, you know, my life seemed like it was on track because I was winning, because alcohol was working. And I'll tell you, for a long time, I would seek that. Well past the effect that alcohol would give me, I would seek that illusion that it somehow, some way, I could get back to being 18 again. And I would continually try that over and over again. And it didn't matter what happened. It didn't matter if my mom fell down the stairs. It didn't matter if I've done that again to her. It didn't matter what would happen, you know, after DUI. It wouldn't matter after I verbally abused and punished my wife. I would feel totally horrible, and I swear to God, I would never want to drink again. But sooner or later, not drinking is not an effective solution for an alcoholic of my type. I am not my dad. I am my grandfather. Facing certain death, knowing that another drink would just get him closer to the grave, he did not have the power to stop drinking, and he would have that drink anyway. Knowing the effects and the consequences of my drinking, knowing that I've just done this again, that I had to bury my cat coming out of a blackout because I hit it coming up the road, it did not have the sufficient force or the sufficient power to alter my drinking. Because then I would just not drink, because I think that just not drinking was a solution to my problem. If I would just stand up straight and I'd be able to work like a worker, if I'd be able to go and, you know, maintain some kind of balance in life, if I could just do these things that you normal people were doing out there, I might have a semblance of what you have, which would be the ability to feel okay in your own skin and maintain a healthy lifestyle. The thing is whenever I just stop drinking without an adequate solution, what happens to me is I become very uncomfortable. The book calls it restless, irritable, and discontent. I call it losing my mind. And it doesn't happen all at once. Okay, I just got my fourth DUI, now I'm not drinking. Well, I tell you what, you know, I mean, I feel all right. Okay, I'm not drinking. I made my decision. I'm just not going to drink. Incrementally, it works on me. And what happens is I become right and you become wrong. I become overly judgmental and I become overly sensitive. And then there's just nobody doing nothing right no more. And I'm bearing down. And I mean, I'm gritting my teeth. But I'm going to tell you what, I'm starting to snap. And it's like Clancy says, there's a spring wind into my gut. And I'll tell you what, I don't know how much more I got left on that spring. And the answer for me, and this is just for me, it always boiled down to not drinking led me to two things. And one was taking my own life, and the other one was the easy way, and that was taking a drink. And I'll tell you what, it would give me that effect after about three or four. You bet. You bet. All right. Everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to be okay. I can get this done. But the problem is once I start drinking, I can't control the amount I take. I'll tell you, man, just being on a golf course with a bunch of lawyers, just, you know, not drinking and thinking that at this time I can just have two because I need to feel human again. I need to feel human. and I'm petrified of what these guys are thinking of me. And I have two drinks on a golf course, and then I'm punching windshields out the state over in a blackout. And I don't know how I'm doing that because I only wanted to have two. But I'll tell you what, it didn't matter if I was punching a windshield out or I was burying my cat or whatever was coming down the pike. I would just not drink, and then I'd slowly go crazy until all of a sudden it didn't matter what I did. A drink seemed like an apparently good idea because I can't stand reality, and I can't stand how I feel without a drink in my system. And that story, that's just the story of all my drinking. You know, the book tells me there's only two choices that we get to make here. One is to die the alcoholic death, and the other one is to live upon spiritual basis of life, a.k.a. the steps being sponsorable. And I'll tell you, you know, a lot of my drinking was looking for door number three, and I'm here to tell you that I never found it, and I think I tried it just about everything. You know, when I finally got married, you know, and I had the wife, all those things that I thought that I could put inside of me to make me feel okay enough that maybe just not drinking would be okay. Because my dad's not drinking and he's happy and he's sober. And if I'm like my dad, you know what? If I get enough of that stuff and I put it in here, I might be able to not drink and lead a successful life. And a lot of that stuff just showed up, you know. And the funny thing is, if you look at your third column, you know, those things like security, those things like personal relationships, all that stuff, I thought if I got that stuff, that I'd be all right. And I did. I went out and I got the house, you know, and I paid for it. I got the trophy wife. I went out and I got the job at the law firm. I got that stuff. And I'll tell you what, just not drinking was not making it. And I thought if I had enough of that, that I might be able to control and enjoy my drinking. And I'll tell you what, not even close. By the time I got here, I was in bad shape, you know. I came to you people, you know, 6-7 years before I got sober. And I mean, I was losing my mind. I came in here and I saw all you people and you guys were all happy and sober and I didn't get it. I said, man, you guys just ain't drinking. You guys are happy. And I had no idea, you know, that you guys took a course of action. You know, I had no idea that there was a different way of life here. I just thought you just came here and you all got together and, you know, and in somehow or another you were able to maintain life, you know, without alcohol in your system. And I would come in here, you know, and I'd hear stories, you know, like you got to take the steps, you know, and I thought the steps were some kind of elevated form of AA. And you had to get a sponsor, and you had to do all this stuff, you know. And I'll tell you what, I just wasn't ready to do it. I had some more drinking to do, you know. And a lot of those questions that I needed to answer, alcohol answered them for me, you know. And what ended up happening was is I just spiraled out of shape. I went out there, and what a lot of people talk about here is that you had to be surrendered by the bottle. And that's what happened to me. There was a time, like, whenever I would, you know, just think to myself, if I could just go out and just be part of something bigger than myself, you know, that maybe that might be a solution, and I went searching for that. You know, I looked at church, and I looked at, like, self-help programs, and I went out, and the shrinks, you know, they had a field day with me. I went out, you know, after an unsuccessful suicide, you know, attempt, and they took me in, and the shrink told me, he's just like, Merv. You know, you probably have a problem with alcoholism, but I got diagnosed with many different things. So I would come in here and I'd try and join these groups. I mean, heck, I even joined a book club, you know, and just trying to find something bigger than myself. And I didn't realize that that's what I was doing. You know, I just felt like I just needed to be around people. And the thing was, is that the fear of what you thought of me always kept me separate from you anyway. And so I started coming back into the rooms of AA, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm an addict, and I'm a sex addict, I'm a marijuana addict, and you can throw, you know, whatever else on there, but there was a lot of stuff going on. And once again, I would come in here, you know, and I hear you guys all talking about get a sponsor and take the steps, you know, get a home group and get active here. But I'm like, well, I understand that, but I'm not quite like you yet. You know, I may have what you have, but, man, I got this other stuff going on, too, you know. And I'll tell you, you know, the funny thing is whenever you're taking an emotional remedy for a spiritual illness, for me, it just didn't take. You know, I got on the medications, and I did all that stuff, and I'm not bashing anybody that's on it. I'm just saying for me, I tried that emotional solution for a spiritual illness, and it just didn't take. I was more miserable than I ever was. The wife was leaving me. She said, you need to get out. And I said, all right. You know, I still owe her an amends because I blew the first one because I couldn't keep my mouth shut. And I'm waiting for that day. And I remain willing, you know, that one day she'll show up at the gas station and I'll be able to get that right. But this is the kind of person that I am. This is the selfishness, self-centeredness that I bring to any relationship, whether I'm drinking or not. And that is, I'm going to get out of you as much as I can. I'm going to suck as much energy out of you, and I'm going to try and rule your life. And that's the way I'm built. And I'll tell you, you know, just like I think the spiritual solution leaks out into the world, when I'm spiritually sick, I think that leaks out too. And here was a woman who was first chair violinist in the UVA Symphony, had her life straight, was going to go back and get her master's, loved her job. And I'll tell you what, normal living came easily to her. By the time she threw me out, after I sucked everything I could out of her, she had to go in for counseling. She was hospitalized. She had many disorders. And that's what I can bring to the show as an untreated alcoholic. See, we think that Alcoholics Anonymous and the gifts we get here is all about us, and I believe that. There are cookies here. You know, I don't get to drink again. I get to seek a spiritual solution and a spiritual awakening through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that's going to save my bacon. But really, I think the best trick God ever played on us is that Alcoholics Anonymous makes the world a safer place from us. You know, all of a sudden the people around us are going to be in better shape because we found a solution here. You know, and I really think that, you know, a lot in the ways that I think the men's process is not all about us either. I think it's more about the other people. And so whenever she booted me out, man, I wish I could say that I was like blindsided by it or, you know, and all that stuff. But now I saw it coming and in the way I wanted it to happen. Because at this point in time, I'm trying to control and enjoy my drinking. And I'll tell you what, I just can't make it. I just can't make it. I'll tell you, you know, just putting a plug in the jug, you know, and I'm like going to AA meetings and I'm just not getting it because I don't identify because my case is seriously different than you. I'm just not quite like you. And what I do is I wait for her to go to bed at night. And I'm just sitting there and I ain't saying nothing to nobody because that's just the way I am without a drink in me. And I'm just staring at her and I'm waiting for her to go to bed until finally about 10 o'clock at night, she can't hang with me no more. She's like, I'm turning in. And then all of a sudden, yeah, it's coming. And I just look down the hallway and I wait for that light to turn off in that bedroom door. And I'll tell you what, man, I'd be happy because I know what's coming. In the trunk of my car, there's a six-pack of Zima, there's a bottle of vodka and a bottle of Listerine and an empty pitcher. And that's what's coming. And I'll tell you what, the first time I saw that movie, Leaving Las Vegas, when he is happy and he's singing and he's just the happiest guy in that liquor store, long before he took a drink, man, I get that. I get that. The happiest I ever was at the end of my drinking was before I took the drink, just the expectation of getting it. And, man, I'll tell you what, I go out to the back of that car and I fill up that pitcher. Man, I put Zimas in there, top it off with a bunch of vodka, and then put some Listerine in just so nobody could smell me. And and I'll tell you, man, just getting that thing down, man, being all right. I'm all right. You know what? Whatever's going on, the problem today, you know what? It's going to be all right. And that, you know, I'll tell you, even if I got like 5 seconds of that, it was well worth it. And I would do that over and over. And I'll tell you, you know, I did that for years. Just, you know, 86 and her out of my life. And incrementally, you know, silent scorn. I mean, all those character defects that we all know so well, passive-aggressive behavior. And what I did was, unconsciously or consciously, I can see it now after going through the steps and getting clear here, especially with working with other alcoholics, that I incrementally pushed her out because I needed to drink the way I wanted to. And I would do that, and I did it successfully. I did it so she pitched me out because I'm a gutless, heartless, scaredy cat, and I didn't want to pull the trigger. I didn't have the guts to do it. So I made her do it, and I put her through a lot of pain to get there. So when she got kicked to the curb, I moved in with some friends, and I checked myself into an outpatient program, got a lot of information, got a lot more diagnoses, and I'll tell you what, 10 days at the most, but man, I'm drinking. And the funny thing was, is all of a sudden I'm drinking the way I want to drink after 6-7 years of trying to control and enjoy my drink, and I'm living through that madness. And I'll tell you, man, it didn't end up nice. I mean, I didn't get what I thought I was going to get, which was 18 again. just like the life of the party and, you know, and man feeling engaged in life and all of a sudden people not being less scary, and it's worse than it's ever been. You know, I can barely get out of the house, you know, and it's like whenever I do get out of the house, I'm having like two drinks and I'm blacking out. I don't understand what's going on, you know, and it just took what it took. Meanwhile, you know, the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, every time I come wandering in, I mean, I look like death. They would say, Merv, we're glad to see you. Thanks for coming back. You know, we're glad to see you. Just keep coming back. And I got out of jail 2 times in 3 days. And for public drunkenness, and that last time I got out of jail was not a pretty sight. What happened to me, I'll share that with anybody, but I'm not going to share from the podium what went down in that prison cell. But whenever I started walking back from that jail, man, something happened. And I think God gave me glimpses all through my life of what kind of was wrong with me. You know, I think God gave me glimpses. But Clancy also talks about places of seconds and inches. And this time, I'll tell you what, being exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous over the 7 years and not taking the actions that you guys kept telling me to do, it became very apparent that I needed to do something different. And for me, it boiled down to a choice of life or death. And because I knew I didn't have much time left on this planet. And whenever I started walking back, it became very apparent to me that I'm no longer going to get to that spot. I'm no longer, even whenever I'm drinking, I'm not getting there. I'm not hitting that bullseye like I used to back when I was 18 to 20 years old. I'm not getting there. I know that not drinking is no longer, is not an option because I can't stand it anymore because my head goes straight back to like trying to drive off the top of the mountain up on 33. Or it's like, you know, drinking, man, I'm more depressed and I'm crying more than ever. So I got to do something different. So, you know, I walked in my poopy pants and I went back to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was very funny that meeting that I went back to was the very first meeting that I did go to 7 years earlier. 7 years earlier, you know, they end that meeting with the promises, the 9-step promises, you know, and I'm up there and it's like my first meeting and they're all, you know, doing the chant and all that stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, you know, I've joined a cult, you know, I mean, what, look at all these crazy people, you know. And I'll tell you what, whenever I walked into that meeting that time, you guys could have told me to shave my head and sell pencils in the airport and I would have done it. I was ready to do something different. I called up a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and it's one of those people that we hate. Especially when you're new, because they're doing all the things and they're talking about the things you're not doing, so of course I'm going to hate them, you know, and that's just the way it was. Never liked them, talked about commitment, talked about seeking God through relationships with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous, how to sacrifice your time and help the newcomer, all those things that I wasn't prepared to do. And but I'll tell you what, they said you never have to drink again if you do certain things, and it intrigued me. And I wanted to know what those certain things were. Here's a person that was going out of town. They were going to an AA conference. And then they were planning a vacation after that. And I called them up and I said, what are these things? I don't want to drink no more. They put their life on hold. They didn't go to the conference. They didn't go on vacation because of paramount for their sobriety that they had to carry this message to the person who still suffered. And they picked up that phone. And they took me into their home. And I'll tell you, you know, it was just like, you know, Bill and Bob's story. I mean, it was, you know, it's eerie how it was. But this person was armed with facts about themselves, you know, and they knew what a sick and suffering alcoholic was. So I went in there and they started talking about, you know, their experience once you start drinking, you know, and they gave me the litany of all their experiences with that. And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, I had a big book sponsor. I know all that stuff. But whenever they started talking about how they felt before they took their first drink, when they started describing what untreated alcoholism looks like, you know, losing your mind until, you know, finally you have to have it. When they started talking about that and the low-lying depression and the resentment and the fear and the anger, man, I was like, oh, man. I was like, man, that's me. And they're like, yeah, Merv, we've been watching you coming in and out of here for 7 years. We've been hoping that you'd turn up and stay alive long enough and maybe hear the message. You know, we're glad you're here, but there are certain things you're going to have to do. And I'll tell you what, you know, even looking back on it today, I don't need to agree with what my sponsor says. I just got to be willing to, you know, take the action that they suggest. And they said, look, you got to get hungry, you got to take the steps, and you have to get commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, because the steps are going to take you to a spiritual awakening, but the commitments in AA will keep you here. And that's what we're all about. And I'll tell you what, I was just like, you bet. You know, and something magically happened. Was that all of a sudden, I'm looking at this person who's happy and sober, who's just like me. And I'm just thinking, man, if I do a little bit of what they do, I might get a little bit of what they have, and that is peace and serenity in their own skin. And that's all I ever wanted. I just wanted to be able to live life as a human being. And I might have a chance if I do what this person tells me to do. And I went along, and I'll tell you, the great thing is here, the only step we have to do perfectly is the first step, and I think I did it. You know, it hit home with me. You know, I conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. But I came to believe that maybe if I do what you people are doing, I might get what you get. So I decided to take the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, I didn't have to do them perfectly. But I'll tell you what, I gave it my best shot, and that's all anybody ever asked me to do. And I'll tell you, you know, for a long time, the things that, you know, kept me away from you, you know, the things that I was scared to do here, it all came down to the fifth and ninth step anyway. Did I really want to share what happened when my mom fell down the stairs? Did I want to talk about the money that I think I owe the IRS at this time? Do I want to talk about this stuff? And I'll tell you, you know, I mean, I was still on the fence. I put it on my fourth step, you know, and I was getting this stuff done, but I'll tell you, I didn't know if I wanted to share it. Being engaged with other members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it doesn't matter what side of the fence you're on, because I think, you know, just like Bob helped Bill and Bill helped Bob, I think we grow shoulder by shoulder, and it doesn't matter what the stance or my position is. Whenever I went to a meeting, and it was a noontime meeting, and I had a coffee commitment, and I still wasn't sure if I was going to share this stuff with another person or not, I went to this coffee commitment, and the one thing that was ingrained in me was that you say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have a choice anymore, Merv. If you're going to truly take a stance of the position of the third step, then your life is going to incrementally become less about you and more about somebody else. And how that's going to work is that you take these actions and steps, but most importantly, you say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. They ask you something, you say yes here. And so I had my little coffee commitment, because coffee makers make it, and you know, and I'm cleaning up my coffee and cleaning out my urn because I'm a winner. And you know, and this guy put his hand up during the announcement, and he said, hey, you know, I have to go on a 12-step call, and, you know, and there's 80 people in there, and nobody goes. And he comes up to me, and he's like, nobody could go. I need somebody to come with me. Will you come with me? And I'm like too busy thinking about myself, and I just lost the wife and all the money, and I don't have the house no more. I got a sleeping bag and like a pair of jeans and a white beater T-shirt, you know. And he's like, I need somebody to go. And I'm like, okay, I'll go. And I went. And I'll tell you, man, I was thinking about myself, my poor, pitiful life. I got a good look at it because there it is on my fourth step. And I went up that elevator all consumed with myself. And I'll tell you, I went up there, and whenever he 12-stepped that guy who remained sober till he died, you know, I had nothing great to say. You know, he'd look at me, and I'd be like, AA works, you know, and that's about all I had, you know. But the magic that happened at that moment in time, and we talk all about it, you know, in our home group, which is I must decrease and you must increase. What happened was that guy became the most important person to me, and it wasn't myself. The guy that went up that elevator and then the guy who came down were two separate people. And I'll tell you what, that conscious awareness of another alcoholic and getting out of myself, all of a sudden it became very apparently aware that maybe I should do this fifth step and I'm going to come clean, and which I did. I shared that stuff, and there was no, you know, get out of this room right now, you sick guy. It was, we've done that too. You know, on the first step, I identify as being an alcoholic. I identify with the allergy that once I start drinking, I can't control the amount I take. I also identify that, you know, not drinking is not a solution and I'm doomed to drink again. But for me, at the fifth step, whenever I sat down with another alcoholic, and actually I did my fifth step with three separate people, it was kind of wacky, but I identified with alcoholism. And I'll tell you, I became very aware of a bunch of stuff, and I became aware that I was a liar, cheat, and a thief, that I was selfish and self-centered to the core, that I treat people miserably. I'm inconsiderate, and I'll tell you what, it doesn't really matter how nice you are to me. I'm going to get what I want, and I'm still going to kick you to the curb, and that was my pattern in life. And, you know, because all my life, you know, if mom just would have been better, if she wouldn't have went to the psych wards, if dad would have been home, if I would have grew up in a trailer that wasn't pink, and, you know, if I would have had that stuff, I mean, I was full-blown victim city. If I would, you know, I did not do this to myself. I'm screwed up because of everybody else. And what the fourth and fifth step exposed to me was is I have to take responsibility, and you know what? You know, you're not the victim anymore. You have responsibilities that you need to take care of. And the great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that, you know, through this process, we get a perception change. And we get a perception change not only about, you know, what I think is true, but also what really happened in my life. You know, and that's a great thing. I did a bunch of sponsor shopping. And I'll tell you, I have a girlfriend at this point in time. She knows how sick I am. You know, a lot of people in here know her. She's like, man, there's this guy down in Buckingham. You know, you might want to go talk to him, you know. And I went down there and I talked to this gentleman and, you know, and he gave me some direction. And because even though I was walking to a bunch of meetings a week and I was trying to get involved here, what happened was just like his sponsors had done before him and their sponsors before him, they set up a structure. And he said, look, you know, you got to make these meetings and keep these meetings. I want you to make some phone calls. I want you to get to meetings early and stay late. I want you to do this stuff. I want you to dress appropriately to meetings. No more wife beaters and flip-flops, bro. You know, you might be a loser, but you don't have to look like one. And, and there was a bunch of this stuff. And I'm like, oh, my God, well, I love my flip-flops. And but I had to do it. And I didn't do it because I did it because I was willing to go to any length, I guess. I was one because I'm looking at a gentleman who has his life together, who is louder than my head, and even though I'm arguing in my mind and I don't understand why I need to do this stuff, I trust him. And I'm willing to do it because I know that, you know, I will be able to maintain some kind of semblance of sobriety. So, you know, long story short, early sobriety, nuts. Get this sponsor, don't have a driver's license yet. Girlfriend gets pregnant, nuts. All of a sudden, amends to the ex-wife, goes bad, and I dig my heels in, and I'm nuts. And, I mean, I'm a progressive alcoholic, and I think I progress whether I drink or not, you know. And I'm progressing, you know, drinking, but I'm also progressing, like, illness-wise, too, you know. And it doesn't take me quit, you know. It doesn't take long. I'm 0 to 60. So what happens is I feel committed, you know, but really I'm coming to meetings and maybe I'm not getting there as early as I should. And I'll tell you, you know, I'm already like a little bit scared of what you people are thinking of me. I'm talking a good game in AA. Man, I got stuff memorized. I'm in here. I can tell you all about it. Yeah, I ain't doing lick. I'm not, there's no 11-step practice anymore. Admitting I'm wrong, you don't have to when you're right all the time. And, you know, and that's just the way it was. And I'll tell you, man, rubber meets the road in sobriety. Rubber meets the road. Commitments and all that stuff, man, that is good stuff. And what happened was is I was able to maintain a focus on trying to work with other alcoholics, even though everything else was kind of getting kicked to the wayside. And what happened was is when she got pregnant and then my son was born, I'm going to tell you what, a whole new level of fear invaded my life. I'll tell you what, you know, am I going to measure up? Am I going to be the dad? You know, am I going to be, I'm going to tell you, that third column comes back to play because even though those are the things that, you know, that are, you know, fearful for me and those are the, you know, like security and that's all the stuff I think can fix me. Just whenever I come into rooms, I'm going to tell you what, I think that stuff can fix me in sobriety too, you know. And I'm telling you, I need to get out of this job. I'm waiting tables at a Greek diner, you know. I need to get back, get a Thai job, you know. I need to get this stuff done. And, you know, AA didn't get kicked to the curb, you know, but really I had thoughts and stuff like that. And what would happen was I'd come in here and I had no honest relationship with anybody with the exception of my sponsor. People were like, Mert, you okay? I'm fine. Thanks for asking. How are you? You know, and that's the way I'm, you know, my relationships are going in AA. And what happened is I got pretty sick. And what happened was is when that baby came, I'm going to tell you, not proud of it. Not proud of my behavior. I mean, I was waiting for the day, you know, when I would come home and my stuff would be in trash bags on the front lawn, because that's the way I'm behaving. I'm coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm talking a good game, but my life at home and my life in the workplace are just going to hell in a handbasket because I don't know how to act. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I don't know how to act like a mature adult. I can intellectualize and understand what these principles mean, but I don't know how to put them into action. And what happened was I had to finish up my amends to get to a place. And for me to become more effective in 10 and 11 and then hence be more effective in carrying this message, I think that that was just a necessary thing that I had to do. What happened was I went back to my family and I made amends. And the great thing is that I do believe this process is all about healing other people, as long as getting a cookie, if I never have to drink, as long as I maintain, you know, these principles in my life. But really, for a long time, kind of darting around, but I want to share this, is I went back to my mom. And for a long time, you know, even though I was thinking that, you know, she was to blame for who I was not quiet about it. I let her know. And at the end, you know, when I shut her out of my life, you know, she was acutely aware that she caused the problems in my life. And she would go to anybody and tell them, yeah, Murphy would be better if I would have done this better for him. And she believed that with all her heart. When I went back to make amends, you know, and I'm like, Mom, you know, I haven't been a great son. I've been selfish. I've taken stuff from you. And you haven't slept for a long time worrying about me. And she's like, oh, no, Murphy. She's just like, no, it's not your fault. It's not your fault, you know, if I would have raised you better. I'm like, Mom, that's not it. That's not it. I said, Mom, I'm responsible for all that stuff. I was a horrible son. You know what? You did the best job you could. You did the best job you could with a guy like me. And she changed. And I said, man, you got to put a stop on that right now. You are not responsible for how it turned out. That is my responsibility. And she got the heat off. Today, to this day, it doesn't come up anymore. You know, she is healed. She no longer has to carry the guilt that I laid on her that she was the cause of all of my problems. She leads a good life now. We have a connection. I let her be a mom, and I can just be a son. And the same things happen with my dad, you know, great connections now, you know, and I didn't do it. It was the process of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was taking actions that I didn't believe would work. And I'll tell you, you know, all of a sudden, you know, whenever I got engaged and I became more involved in the home group down in Buckingham at that time, before we got our group started up here in Charlottesville, you know, I started making relationships, and I'm looking around these rooms, and I'm like, oh, my God, look at all these Buckingham characters, you know. I mean, I don't own a gun, and, you know, and where is he, Sarsage? And, you know, and then came along a gentleman in AA who I've known longer than anybody else besides my sponsor. And we used to make this ride down, and all of a sudden I started making personal connections. These guys, I'm going to tell you what. You know, just being surrounded by, you know, all this great sobriety, and they would come up and tell me how they've fallen, how they've goofed up, how they've come up short. And then they would show me the actions that they took to make that right. One of the greatest things that ever happened to me in AA was the day that I saw my sponsor make a mistake. He was on the stairs and he got accused of something and he owed up right there in front of all the guys he sponsors. He said, man, I made a mistake. You know, I am sorry. You know, what can I do that make this right? I'm going to tell you what, I need to see that because I didn't even know how to do that. And then whenever I saw that, I was able to take that home. And I'll tell you, you know, and what happens here is that the actions and the commitments that I keep here, it makes me a better person out in life. You know, by learning how to come in here and play with you people, it makes it a little bit easier to go out and play with all those people. You know, by keeping a commitment and following the traditions in a home group, and showing up and being able to keep my mouth closed whenever a, you know, self-important Merv wants to come out and run the show, but how I can be quiet and how I can be engaged in a helpful manner. I'm going to tell you what, that is all about fatherhood today. That's all about being a boss. And that I could not have that if I don't do that here. There is no other way around. My life out there is solely contingent on the actions that I take in here. That life out there is a result of what I do in the rooms of AA. And I know that in my heart today. you know. I wish I could say that I'm a get it right guy. If it was a poster child for slow sobriety, I am that guy, you know, and I am, you know. The book talks about, you know, that the only way we grow spiritually is through self-sacrifice and working with others, you know, and I believe that today. You know, by me setting aside time, setting aside what I think I need to get done in order to help the sick and suffering alcoholic, I'll tell you, you know, I need to be humble enough to do that. You know, because what happens is the magic by working with another alcoholic is just the greatest thing. I can go on, you know, and I can be aware of God. You know, it's easy to look back and see how God has played a, you know, part in my life, you know, and it's easy for me to look back, you know, and I've always heard the voice or the actions that I need to take expressed from God through the members of Alcoholics Anonymous by, you know, making a conscious contact with them, whether my butt's on fire or not. But I'll tell you, you know, I mean, the whenever I'm working with somebody and I'm sitting there and I got that guy in the car, and I always make them fifth step in the car. Then that way, you know, I can drive off or do something, you know. And they're sitting there, and you just know they're just scared to death of sharing something, you know. And I'll tell you, you know, early on, that person who 12-stepped me into the program, they said, Merv, the horror show of your life, whatever you think is that horror show, whether you're drinking or not, and this will be a principle you'll carry throughout your sobriety, all that is going to become useful in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what you need to do here is you need to take that stuff through this process so it'll be available for the person. And I'll tell you, countless times, all that stuff that I held on to that I never thought, you know, would be useful, every single thing, and this is not podium flash, every single thing I've done wrong in my life has been useful to benefit another alcoholic, whether keeping them at ease or just letting them know that they're not the only person that's done that. And I'll tell you, you know, I mean, that's why I must stay fully engaged here. Because I am alcoholic and I'm human, and I'll tell you what, mistakes are coming, you know, and I made plenty of them. I'll just share a couple of stories and I'll shut it down. Members of Alcoholics Anonymous and the importance of a home group and having vital connections with those people, I just tell you what, you never know when it's going to come in useful. And I shared the one earlier about coming home from the conference, and I'll tell you, you know, it's still real easy for me to be okay in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'll tell you, when I get agitated, when things aren't going my way, the people that are going to pay in my life is my family and my workers. And that's still a truth. I mean, it's the lesson to a great degree. But I'll tell you, you know, I'm still 0-60. There was a point in time, my girlfriend went to see her sponsor in L.A., and it was the first time I had to stay home with my son. And I'm scared. You know, I'm like petrified. I'm still like in that phase of like deer in the headlights, dad, and don't know what I'm doing. And, you know, I get to a couple of meetings, but the most important thing that happened was as I asked my home group guys to go out. And, you know, my son wanted to get sushi. Please come out with me. And those guys, you know, they came. You know, and it was a great night. My son, you know, he had like one piece. But really, my son, you know, these guys, that core of guys, I mean, those are his uncles. These are the people that teach them how to shoot a BB gun correctly. These are the people that show them how to be act like a mature adult and engage in conversation, what a handshake is. These are his uncles, you know, and we all go out and he feels engaged. And to this day, I mean, all our little me characters on the Wii games are all home group guys. I mean, it's great, you know. Merle kind of stinks at third base, but, you know, other than that. You know. And, but, you know, we get done, we get back to the house, and, you know, all weekend long we've been drawing all these pictures for his mom whenever she gets home, and, you know, and he's hungry, and I make him some soup, and it was entirely way too hot, and I handed him the bowl, and it was hot, and he burnt his hands, and he dumped that soup all over those pictures, and, you know, 0-60, what do you think? Oh, let me help you with that. No, that's not what came out of my mouth. My mouth was, you know, what the hell is wrong with you? And I'll tell you what, I laid into him and then I picked up those pictures and I put them in the trash. And that's the place I can get to still today. And I said, I went back in that hallway and I'll tell you what, he's welling up in tears and I don't know what's, I'm ready to fly apart. And I don't know what it was. I thought about those guys that were out for sushi and I thought about God and something happened that I needed to turn right back around. And I went back in there and I said, look, I said, I was out of line. I said, you know, I shouldn't have talked to you like that. And I said, I just got scared. And I said, what can I do? And he said, I just want my pictures back. So I got those pictures out, and we cleaned them up. And the ones that were ruined, we redrew them. And and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me today, in my relationships. And I need that. There is nothing between me and my son today. There is nothing between us. And I owe that to the examples of the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and most importantly, I owe that to the people in my home group. Because I cannot muster that on my own power. There's just been countless times like that. There's been countless times. The amends process, the fear, the big one, the last amends that I had my heels dug in on was I didn't want to pay the IRS back. When I was like 19 years old, I got a check for $1,450 and I thought I was supposed to get $450 back. And I'm like, I ain't paying them back. I spent it, and it's just weird how this works out. I have my heels in. That's the last one. And isn't it funny that I still have the fear of financial insecurity with an unpaid amends, and we talk about how alcoholics help, the new man will help us more than we could ever help them. And I'll tell you what, that's been my experience. I have my heels dug in. I work with a bunch of guys, and we're all in a ninth step, and we're reading that part in the book, May drink again unless we lose fear to face our creditors. I can't say I'm going to ninth step meetings at this point either, because I know I'm holding on to that one last one. I don't measure up. I'm going to get up here and I'm going to talk good, and don't measure up. And I'll tell you what, and I read that with the last sponsee, the same paragraph over again, and I'm like, oh my God, how can I carry this message if I'm not doing the deal? The first step may be the coal car that's feeding the engine that drives, but I'll tell you what, the engine today is the primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I'm going to be rocketed to the fourth dimension, the ship that will carry me will be Alcoholics Anonymous, the actions, the rooms, the fellowship. I was sitting in the drive-thru at Burger King, and I lost it. And I said, I got to get it done. And I got a couple of double cheeseburgers, and I pulled it in. And I'm sitting there, and I make the call. And I call the IRS, and they're like, you got to call this other number, a local number, and I call them. Get somebody on the phone. I tell them the whole story. I'm like, I owe you $1,000 from 1988. And they're like, hold on there, boy. And I talk to another person who ships me to another person. About an hour and a half after this, conversation in the car, got like mustard on me and stuff. And they're like, Mr. Lingle, in 1988, you had a tax credit. You got the appropriate amount of money. And we'd like it if you'd stop calling us. I'm like, I'm mad now because I want to pay the money back so I can sound good, and I'll tell you what, and I was like, wow, all those years of waiting for the IRS cops to come take me to the camp, and it's all for nothing, this process changed my perception of my past, and I'm tell you what, fancied or real, they're going to kill me, and I'll tell you, about 2 months after that, maybe a little bit longer, maybe 6 months, I had the highest paying job I've ever had. And I lost it. They fired a bunch of people. And I was one of them. And I have it, it's on me now. What am I going to do? Money, I called my sponsor, and then I called my wife. Or my girlfriend. Sponsor, then the girlfriend. I went home, and it was, I'm fearful, but I'm all right, And then it's on me. Everybody's in bed, now it's on me, and I got a call from a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I talked to another member after that. And I'll tell you, I wonder if I would have held on and not made that amends, what that outcome would have been, what would have happened. But I'll tell you what, by the end of that night, man, I was able to go to sleep. And what they basically told me was, Merv, you're acting like your primary purpose is yourself. Your job is what you do for money. What you do for employment is what you do for money. Your job here is to help the sick and suffering alcoholic. That's your real job, and I need reminders of that, and I get that all the time. then, you know, and today, you know, I mean, you know, I get flashes of those fears, but they don't dominate me. I'm pretty regular in my meeting attendance. In fact, I'm very regular. The commitments that I keep, I mean, I have a job in my home group, you know, and I help out with other conferences. You know, and God definitely has a sense of humor here. You know, my favorite commitment of all time, there used to be a conference down in Virginia Beach called Pockets of Enthusiasm. And this will tell you God has a sense of humor. Oh, man, you know, and my sponsor said, well, you got to follow this guy around and help him make coffee. And then the next year I was the coffee maker for the conference, you know, and I'm like, oh, you know, and I loved it. That was my favorite thing of all time, was being the coffee maker for this conference. And God definitely has a sense of humor because I manage a coffee shop now, you know, and, it's just as good as the coffee here. And it's good stuff. The last thing I'll share is just a quick story. And what it was, you know, when we talk about how everything becomes useful, the perception change, the idea change, how our life will be, our life will have a new meaning, which is the name of this conference. I love it. And really, you know, there's a daily perception change and then there's a big one. You know, I've sought the spiritual experience. I've done the steps. I've had one. But just like Bill Wilson, I know that the spiritual experience doesn't last that long, that it needs to be followed up by continual action. And those actions are my responsibility. You know, I need to maintain, you know, consistency here. You know, and when Bill got his, I'll never forget it. You know, I mean, it amazed me. Bill had this white light experience and then he wanted to get drunk. And then he made all those phone calls and he found Dr. Bob. And it's been a long debate in my head. I know Bill carried the message to Bob, but I think Bob saved Bill's life. You know, I really do, you know, because they help us more than we can help them. There was a point in time where, you know, I'm out, we live in a house, I'm in the middle of an oak forest, and there's all these trees, and all the guys in the home group are sick of hearing this story, but I'll tell them. And I'm looking at them, and, you know, all the leaves are like ugly brown, yellow, you know, and it's just like, man, all of a sudden, and, you know, over time, I'm like, God dang, man, these trees are ugly, man. I'm looking at all the, like, the red maples and stuff, and over on the other properties and stuff, and I'm like, man, how come my place doesn't look like that, you know? And at this time, you know, my son's, like, in his day program, and I get to go to school with him, and it's like this thing, and it's pretty neat, you know? So I go to this, and, I mean, I have a chainsaw now. Chainsaw is all lubed up. There's gas and a can of extra gas. And I know that if I take this long way around, I put Dark Star by the Grateful Dead, and he's going to pass out, you know, and I'll be able to get him passed out in the car, and then I can put him to bed, and then I can start bringing these trees down. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm not talking to anybody about any of this. This is just alcoholic, keen alcoholic mind in action here. And, and it works out, man. He falls asleep, and I'm on this back way around trying to get to Earliesville, and I'm looking up, you know, and all the mountains. Oh, looks like God's water colors. Oh, look at that red. I've never seen that shade of red. And I'm like, those damn ugly yellow trees, you know. And I'm looking over the horizon, and over in the distance, I see, like, what looks like a bouquet of flowers, and it's this beautiful patch of trees. I'm like, oh, man, I want to live there. And I start getting close to home. And I'm looking, and that bouquet of trees, that's my house. And I take a left, and I go down the lane. I'm like, oh, man, you know, and I'm like, you know, it's heaven on earth. Everything I'm searching for, I'm already in the middle of. And I just don't know. You know, I never know. I never know I'm in the middle of, you know, most beautiful places here and now. But I never know it until I'm there. And the thing is, I had to take a different attitude, which is a different direction and course of action. And that's what I did. And then I was able to see the beauty coming from a different angle. That's why I think the engagement with newcomers, engagement with people in my home group, engagement, and most importantly, remaining sponsorable in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I keep those things in place, that structure, what's going to happen is I'm always going to find that place. I'm always going to end up there. But it's my responsibility to maintain this course of action. And the great thing about it today is, since early on I had great examples, members of a home group, great people from outside of town, and most importantly, other active pockets of enthusiasm, such as Joyce's home group, such as the home group down in Buckingham, other places I've stumbled into in Maine, in Georgia, in different places. Man, it always gets me back to that place. But it all always starts with a conscious contact with God, conscious contact with another alcoholic, then the end result, putting my hand out, making sure that I'm still getting there a half hour early, that I'm always staying late, and always trying to take an interest in somebody, you know, other than myself. And I'm glad. Thank you for the committee for asking me to come down. I know the next speaker is coming up. It's going to be awesome. I do question Billy's, you know, sanity because he's repeated the same action and probably got the same result. Thanks for having me.